Subchapter 2. He was younger then. The memories were still fresh. He discussed them with the frozen, seemingly sleeping people sometimes on his wanderings through the cold, dark ship, and wondered, in its silence, if he really was mad. The experience of being frozen and of then being woken up had done nothing to dull his memories. They remained keen and bright. He had rather hoped that the claims they made for freezing were over-optimistic, and the brain did indeed lose at least some of its information. He'd secretly desired that attrition, but been disappointed. The process of warning and revival was actually rather less traumatic and confusing than coming round after being knocked unconscious, something that had happened to him a few times in his life. Revival was smoother, took longer, and was really quite pleasant. In truth, quite like waking up after a good night's sleep. They left him alone for a couple of hours after they'd run the medical checks and pronounced him fit and well. He sat, wrapped in a big, thick towel on the bed, and, like somebody probing a diseased tooth with tongue or finger, unable to stop checking that it really does hurt every now and again, he called up his memories, going through the roll call of those old and recent adversaries he'd hoped he might have lost somewhere in the darkness and the cold of space. All his past was indeed present, and everything that had been wrong present too, and correct. The ship was called the Absent Friends. Its journey would take it over a century. It was a mercy voyage, in a way. Its services donated by its alien owners to help assuage the after-effects of a terrible war. He had not really deserved his place, and had used false papers and a false name to secure his escape. He'd volunteered to be woken up near the middle of the journey, to provide part of the human crew because he thought it would be a shame to travel in space and never really know it, never appreciate it, never look out into that void. Those who did not choose to do crew duty would be drugged on planet, taken into space unconscious, frozen out there, and then wake up on another planet. This seemed undignified to him. To be treated so was to become cargo. The two other people on duty when he was woken were Kai and Erens. Erens had been supposed to return to the ranks of the frozen people 5 years earlier, after a few months of duty on the ship, but had decided to stay awake until they arrived at their destination. Kai had been revived 3 years later, and should also have gone back to sleep, to be replaced after a few months by the next person on the crew rota. But by then Erens and Kai had started to argue, and neither wanted to be the first to return to the stasis of the freeze. There had been stalemate for 2.5 years, while the great slow ship moved, quiet and cold, past the distant pinprick lights that were the stars. Finally they'd woken him up, at last, because he was next on the rota, and they wanted somebody else to talk to. As a rule, however, he just sat in the crew section and listened to the two of them argue. "There's still 50 years to go," Kai reminded Erens. Erens waved a bottle. "I can wait. It isn't forever." Kai nodded at the bottle. "You'll kill yourself with that stuff, and all the other junk you take. You'll never make it. You'll never see real sunlight again, or taste rain. You won't last 1 year, let alone 50. You should go back to sleep." "It isn't sleep. You should go back to it, whatever you want to call it. You should let yourself be frozen again." "And it isn't literally frozen. Freezing, either." Erens looked annoyed and puzzled at the same time. The man they'd woken up wondered how many hundreds of times the two had been through this argument. "You should go back into your little cold cubicle like you were supposed to 5 years ago, and get them to treat you for your addictions when they revive you," Kai said. "The ship already treats me," Erens told Kai, with a kind of slow, drunken dignity. "I am in a state of grace with my enthusiasms. Sublimely tensioned grace." So saying, Erens tipped the bottle back and drained it. "You'll kill yourself. It's my life. You might kill us all, everybody on the whole ship, sleepers too. The ship looks after itself." Erens sighed, looking round the crew lounge. It was the only dirty place on the ship. Everywhere else the ship's robots tidied, but Erens had worked out how to delete the crew lounge from the craft's memory, and so the place could look good and scruffy. Erens stretched, kicking a couple of small recyclable cups off the table. "Huh?" Kai said. "What if you've damaged it with all your messing around?" "I have not been messing around with it," Erens said, with a small sneer. "I have altered a few of the more basic housekeeping programs. It doesn't talk to us anymore, and it lets us keep this place looking lived in. That's about it. Nothing that's going to make the ship wander into a star or start thinking it's human, and what are these intestinal parasites doing in there?" "But you wouldn't understand. No technical background." "Livu, here. He might understand, eh?" Erens stretched out further, sliding down the grubby seat, boots scraping on the filthy surface of the table. "You understand, don't you, Darak?"
"I don't know," he admitted.
He was used to answering to Darak, or Mr. Livu, or just Livu by now.
"I suppose if you know what you're doing, there's no real harm."
Erens looked pleased.
"On the other hand, a lot of disasters have been caused by people who thought they knew what they were doing."
"Amen," Kai said, looking triumphant, and leant aggressively towards Erens. "See?"
"As our friend said,"
Erens pointed out, reaching for another bottle. "He doesn't know." "You should go back with the sleepers," Kai said.
"They're not sleeping."
"You're not supposed to be up right now. There's only supposed to be two people up at any point."
"You go back then."
"It isn't my turn. You were up first."
He left them to argue.
Sometimes he would put a spacesuit on and go through the airlock into the storage sections, which were in vacuum. The storage sections made up most of the ship, over 99% of it. There was a tiny drive unit at one end of the craft, an even tinier living unit at the other, and, in between, the bulging bulk of the ship, packed with the undead. He walked the cold, dark corridors, looking from side to side at the sleeper units. They looked like drawers in a filing cabinet. Each was the head end of something very like a coffin. A little red light glowed faintly on each one, so that standing in one of the gently spiralling corridors, with its own suit light switched off, those small and steady sparks curved away in a ruby lattice folded over the darkness, like some infinite corridor of red giant suns set up by some obsessively tidy-minded god. Spiralling gradually upwards, moving away from the living unit at what he always thought of as the head of the ship, he walked up through its quiet, dark body. Usually he took the outermost corridor, just to appreciate the scale of the vessel. As he ascended, the pull of the ship's fake gravity gradually decreased. Eventually, walking became a series of skidding leaps in which it was always easier to hit the ceiling than make any forward progress. There were handles on the coffin drawers. He used them once walking became too inefficient, pulling himself along towards the waist of the ship, which, as he approached it, turned one wall of coffin drawers to a floor and the other to a ceiling in places. Standing under a radial corridor, he leapt up,
floated towards what was now the ceiling with the radial corridor chimney up through it. He caught a coffin drawer handle and used a succession of them as rungs, climbing into the centre of the ship. Running through the centre of the absent friends, there was an elevator shaft that extended from living unit to drive unit. In the very centre of the whole ship, he would summon the elevator, if it wasn't already waiting there from last time. When it came, he would enter it, floating inside the squat, yellow-lit cylinder. He would take out a pen, or a small torch, and place it in the centre of the elevator car, and just float there, watching the pen or torch, waiting to see if he had stationed it so exactly in the centre of the whole slowly spinning mass of the ship that it would stay where he'd left it. He got very good at doing this, eventually, and could spend hours sitting there with the suit lights and the elevator lights on sometimes, if it was a pen, or off, if it was a torch, watching the little object, waiting for his own dexterity to prove greater than his patience, waiting for, in other words, he could admit to himself, one part of his obsession to win over the other. If the pen or torch moved and eventually connected with the walls or floor or ceiling of the elevator car, or drifted through the open door, then he had to float, climb, down, and then pull and walk back the way he had come. If it stayed still in the centre of the car, he was allowed to take the elevator back to the living unit.
"Come on, Darak," Aaron said, lighting up a pipe.
"What brought you along on this one-way ride, eh?"
"I don't want to talk about it."
He turned up the ventilation to get rid of Aaron's drug fumes. They were in the viewing carousel, the one place in the ship where you could get a direct view of the stars. He came up here every now and again, opened the shutters and watched the stars spin slowly overhead. Sometimes he tried to read poetry. Aaron still visited the carousel alone as well, but Kai no longer did. Aaron's reckoned Kai got homesick, seeing the silent nothingness out there, and the lonely specks that were other suns.
"Why not?" Aaron said.
He shook his head and sat back in the couch, looking out into the darkness.
"It isn't any of your business."
"I'll tell you why I came along if you tell me why you did," Aaron's grinned, making the words sound childish, conspiratorial.
"Get lost, Aaron's."
"Mine is an interesting story. You'd be fascinated."
"I'm sure," he sighed.
"But I won't tell you unless you tell me first."
"You're missing a lot."
"Mm-hmm."
"Well, I'll just have to live with that," he said.
He turned down the lighting in the carousel until the brightest thing in it was Aaron's face, glowing red with the reflected light on each drawer of the pipe. He shook his head when Aaron's offered him the drug.
"You need to loosen up, my friend," Aaron's told him, slumping back in the other seat.
"Get high.
Share your problems."
"What problems?"
He saw Aaron's head shake in the darkness.
"Nobody on this ship hasn't got problems, friend. Nobody out here not running away from something."
"Ah, ship psychiatrists now, are we?"
"Hey, come on. Nobody's going back, are they? Nobody on here's ever going back home. Half the people we know are probably dead already, and the ones that aren't will be by the time we get where we're going. So if we can't ever see the people we used to know again, and probably never see home again, there has to be something pretty damn important and pretty damn bad, pretty damn evil, to make a body up and leave like that.
We all got to be running from something, whether it's something we did or something we had done to us.
Maybe some people just like travelling."
"That's crap.
Nobody likes travelling that much."
He shrugged.
"Whatever."
"Oh, Darak, come on, argue, damn it."
"I don't believe in argument," he said, looking out into the darkness, and saw a towering ship, a capital ship, ringed with its layers and levels of armament and armour, dark against the dusk light, but not dead.
"You don't?"
Aaron said, genuinely surprised.
"Shit, and I thought I was a cynical one."
"It's not cynicism," he said flatly.
"I just think people overvalue argument because they like to hear themselves talk."
"Oh, well, thank you." "It's comforting, I suppose." He watched the stars wheel like absurdly slow shells seen at night, rising, peaking, falling,
and reminded himself that the stars too would explode, perhaps one day.
"Most people are not prepared to have their minds changed," he said. "And I think they know in their hearts that other people are just the same. And one of the reasons people become angry when they argue is that they realize just that, as they trot out their excuses."
"Excuses, eh? Well, if this ain't cynicism, what is?"
Aaron snorted.
"Yes, excuses," he said, with what Aaron's thought might just have been a trace of bitterness. "I strongly suspect the things people believe in are usually just what they instinctively feel is right. The excuses, the justifications, the things you're supposed to argue about come later. They're the least important part of the belief. That's why you can destroy them, win an argument, prove the other person wrong, and still they believe what they did in the first place."
He looked at Aaron's. "You've attacked the wrong thing."
"So what do you suggest one does, Professor, if one is not to indulge in this futile arguing stuff?"
"Agree to disagree," he said. "Or fight."
"Fight?"
He shrugged.
"What else is left?"
"Negotiate." "Negotiation is a way to come to a conclusion. It's the type of conclusion that I'm talking about.
Which basically is disagree or fight, if it comes to it."
Aaron's was silent for a while, drawing on the pipe until its red glow faded, then saying,
"You have a military background at all, yeah?"
He sat and watched the stars.
Eventually he turned his head and looked at Aaron's. "I think the war gave us all a military background, don't you?"
Aaron said. They both studied the slowly moving star field. Twice in the depths of the sleeping ship, he almost killed somebody. One of those times, it was somebody else. He stopped on the long, spiraling outer corridor about halfway to the waist of the ship, where he felt very light on his feet, and his face was a little flushed with effects of normal blood pressure working against the reduced pull. He hadn't intended to look at any of the stored people. The truth was, he never really thought about them in any but the most abstract way. But suddenly he wanted to see something more of a sleeper than just a little red light. He stopped at one of the coffin drawers. He had been shown how to work them after he'd volunteered to act as crew, and had another, rather perfunctory, run through the procedures shortly after being revived. He turned the suit lights on, flipped out the drawer's control pad, and carefully, using one bulky, gloved finger, keyed in the code that Aaron said turned off the ship's monitoring system. A little blue light came on. The red light stayed steady. If it flashed, the ship knew there was something wrong. He unlocked the cabinet, drew the whole device sliding out. He looked at the woman's name, printed on a plastic strip stuck to the head unit. No one he knew, anyway, he thought. He opened the inner cover. He looked in at the woman's calm, deathly pale face. His lights reflected on the crinkled, transparent plastic wrapping covering her like something you'd buy in a shop. Tubes in her nose and mouth, leading away beneath her. A small screen flashed on above her tied-up hair on the head unit. He looked. She seemed in good shape for somebody so nearly completely dead. Her hands were crossed across the chest of the paper tunic she wore. He looked at her fingernails, like Aaron's had said.
quite long, but he'd seen people grow them longer. He looked at the control pad again, entered another code. Lights flashed all over the control surface. The red light did not start flashing, but almost everything else did. He opened a little red and green door set in the top of the head unit. Out of it, he took a small sphere of what looked like fine green wires, containing an ice-blue cube. A compartment alongside gave access to a covered switch. He pushed the cover back, put his finger down to the switch. He held the woman's recorded brain patterns, backed up onto the little blue cube. Easily crushable. His other hand, finger resting on the small switch, could turn off her life. He wondered if he would do it, and seemed to wait for a while, as if expecting some part of his own mind to assume control from him. A couple of times it seemed to him that he felt the start of the impulse to throw the switch, and could have started to do so just an instant later, but each time suppressed the urge. He left his finger there, looked at the small cube inside its protective cage. He thought how remarkable and at the same time how oddly sad it was that all of a human mind could be contained in something so small. Then he reflected that a human brain was not so very much bigger than the little blue cube, and used resources and techniques far more ancient, and so was no less impressive, and still as sad. He closed the woman up again in her chill sleep, and continued on his slow-motion walk to the center of the ship. "I don't know any stories."
"Everybody knows stories," Kai told him.
"I don't. Not proper stories."
"What's a proper story?"
Kai sneered. They sat in the crew lounge, surrounded by their debris. He shrugged. "An interesting one. One people want to listen to."
"People want to listen to different things. What one person would call a proper story might not please somebody else."
"Well, I can only go by what I think would be a proper story. And I don't have any. Not stories that I want to tell, anyway." He grinned coldly at Kai.
"Ah, that's different."
Kai nodded. "Indeed it is."
"Well, tell me what you believe in, then," Kai said, leaning towards him.
"Why should I?"
"Why shouldn't you? Tell me, because I asked."
"No."
"Don't be so standoffish. We're the only three people for billions of kilometers, and the ship's a bore. Who else is there to talk to?"
"Nothing."
"Exactly. Nothing and nobody."
Kai looked pleased. "No. I meant that's what I believe in. Nothing."
"At all?"
He nodded. Kai sat back, thoughtful, nodding.
"They must have hurt you bad."
"Who?"
"Whoever robbed you of whatever it was you used to believe in."
He shook his head slowly. "Nobody ever robbed me of anything," he said. Kai was silent for a while, so he sighed and said,
"So, Kai, what do you believe in?"
Kai looked at the blank screen that covered most of one wall of the lounge.
"Something other than nothing?"
"Anything with a name is other than nothing," he said.
"I believe in what's around us," Kai said, arms crossed, sitting back in the seat. "I believe in what you can see from the carousel. What we'd see if that screen was on, although what you'd see wouldn't be the only sort of what I believe in that I believe in."
"In a word, Kai," he said.
"Emptiness," Kai said with a flickering, jittery smile. "I believe in emptiness."
He laughed. "That's pretty close to nothing."
"Not really,"
Kai said.
"Looks it to most of us."
"Let me tell you a sort of story."
Must you?
No more than you must listen.
Yeah. Okay, then. Anything to pass the time.
The story is this. It's a true story, by the way. Not that that matters. There's a place where the existence or non-existence of souls is taken very seriously indeed. Many people, whole seminaries, colleges, universities, cities, and even states, devote almost all their time to the contemplation and disputation of this matter and related topics. About 1,000 years ago, a wise philosopher king, who was considered the wisest man in the world, announced that people spent too much time discussing these things and could, if the matter was settled, apply their energies to more practical pursuits which would benefit everybody. So he would end the argument once and for all. He summoned the wisest men and women from every part of the world and of every known persuasion to discuss the matter. It took many years to assemble every single person who wished to take part, and the resulting debates, papers, tracts, books, intrigues, and even fights and murders took even longer. The philosopher king took himself off to the mountains to spend these years alone, emptying his mind of everything so that he would be able, he hoped, to come back once the process of argument was ended and pronounce the final decision. After many years, they sent for the king, and when he felt ready, he listened to everyone who thought they had something to say on the existence of souls. When they had all said their piece, the king went away to think. After a year, the king announced he had come to his decision. He said that the answer was not quite so simple as everybody had thought, and he would publish a book, in several volumes, to explain the answer. The king set up 2 publishing houses, and each published a great and weighty volume. One repeated the sentences, "Souls do exist. Souls do not exist." Time after time, part after part, page after page, section after section, chapter after chapter, book after book. The other repeated the words, "Souls do not exist. Souls do exist," in the same fashion. In the language of the kingdom, I might add, each sentence had the same number of words, even the same number of letters. These were the only words to be found beyond the title page in all the thousands of pages in each volume. The king had made sure that the books began and finished printing at the same time, and were published at the same time, and that exactly the same number were published. Neither of the publishing houses had any perceivable superiority or seniority over the other. People searched the volumes for clues. They looked for a single repetition buried deep in the volumes, where a sentence or even a letter had been missed out or altered, but they found none. They turned to the king himself, but he had taken a vow of silence and bound up his writing hand. He would still nod or shake his head in reply to questions concerning the governing of his kingdom, but on the subject of the 2 volumes and the existence or otherwise of souls, the king would give no sign. Furious disputes arose. Many books were written. New cults began. Then, a half year after the 2 volumes had been published, 2 more appeared. And this time the house that had published the volume beginning, "Souls Do Not Exist," published the volume which began, "Souls Do Exist." The other publisher followed suit, so that theirs now began, "Souls Do Not Exist." This became the pattern. The king lived to be very old, and saw several dozen volumes published. When he was on his deathbed, the court philosopher placed copies of the book on either side of him, hoping the king's head would fall to one side or the other at the moment of death, so indicating by the first sentence of the appropriate volume which conclusion he had really come to. But he died with his head straight on the pillow, and with his eyes under the eyelids, looking straight ahead. "That was 1,000 years ago," Kai said.
the books are published still. They've become an entire industry, an entire philosophy, a source of unending argument, and...
Is there an ending to this story? He asked, holding up one hand.
No, Kai smiled smugly.
There is not.
But that is just the point.
He shook his head, got up, and left the crew lounge.
But just because something does not have an ending, Kai shouted, doesn't mean it doesn't have a...
The man closed the elevator door, outside in the corridor. Kai rocked forward in the seat and watched the lift level indicator ascend to the middle of the ship.
Conclusion, Kai said, quietly.
He'd been revived nearly half a year when he almost killed himself. He was in the elevator car, watching a torch he had left in the center of the car as it slowly spun. He had left the torch switched on and put out all the other lights. He watched the tiny spot of light move slowly around the circular wall of the car, slow as any clock hand. He remembered the searchlights of the Stabberind, and wondered how far they were away from it now. So far that even the sun itself must be weaker than a searchlight seen from space. He did not know why that made him think of just taking off the helmet, but found himself starting to do it, nevertheless. He stopped. It was quite a complicated procedure to open the suit while in vacuum. He knew each of the steps, but it would take some time. He looked at the white spot of light which the torch was shining on the wall of the lift, not far from his head. The white spot was gradually coming closer as the torch spun. He would start to ready the suit to take the helmet off. If the torch beam hit his eye... No, his face, any part of his head. Before that, then he would stop and go back as though nothing had happened. Otherwise, if the spot of light did not strike his face in time, he would take the helmet off and die. He allowed himself the luxury of letting the memories wash over him, while his hands slowly began the sequence that would end, unless interrupted, with the helmet being blasted off his shoulders by the air pressure. Stabberind, the great metal ship stuck in stone, and a stone ship, a building stuck in water, and the two sisters. Darkens, Livweta, and of course he'd realized at the time that he was taking their names, or something like their names, in making the one he masqueraded under now. And Zakalwe, and Elethiomel. Elethiomel the Terrible. Elethiomel the Chairmaker. The suit beeped at him, trying to warn him he was doing something very dangerous. The spot of light was a few centimeters from his head. Zakalwe. He tried to ask himself what the name meant to him. What did it mean to anybody? Ask them all back home. What does this name mean to you? War, perhaps, in the immediate aftermath. A great family, if your memory was long enough. A kind of tragedy, if you knew the story. He saw the chair again, small and white. He closed his eyes, tasting bitterness in his throat. He opened his eyes. Three final clips to go, then one quick twist. He looked at the spot of light. It was invisible, so close to the helmet, so close to his head. The torch in the center of the elevator car was facing almost straight at him, its lens bright. He undid one of the three final helmet clips. There was a tiny hiss, barely noticeable. Dead, he thought,
seeing the girl's pale face. He undid another clip. The hiss grew no louder. There was a sense of brightness at the side of the helmet, where the light would be shining. Metal ship, stone ship, and the unconventional chair. He felt tears come to his eyes, and one hand, the one not undoing the third helmet clip, went to his chest, where, under the many synthetic layers of the suit, beneath the fabric of the undersuit, there was a small puckered mark on the skin just over his heart, a scar that was 2 decades old, or 7 decades old, depending how you measured time. The torch swung, and just as the final clip came undone, and the spot of light started to leave the inside edge of the suit to shine on his face, the torch flickered and went out. He stared. It was almost totally dark. There was the hint of light from outside the car, the faintest of red glows produced by all the near-dead people and the quietly watching equipment. Out. The torch had gone out. Charge exhausted or just a fault, it didn't matter. It had gone out. It hadn't shone on his face. The suit beeped again, plaintive above the quiet hiss of escaping air. He looked down at the hand that lay over his chest. He looked back up at where the torch must be, unseen in the centre of the car, in the centre of the ship, in the middle of its journey. How do I die now? He thought. He did go back to his chill sleep after a year. Erens and Kai, their sexual predilections forever estranging them despite the fact they seemed like a well-matched couple otherwise, were still arguing when he left. He ended up in another low-tech war, learning to fly because he knew now that aircraft would always win against the battleship, and flying the frosty vortices of air above the vast white islands that were the colliding tabular icebergs.